Welcome to A Penny for Your Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by Sean Blumgren and Andrew Penny from Central Iowa. On our podcast, we discuss all things agronomy, high yield management, and give you real-time updates on what we're seeing and hearing from the field. We will also gain insight from industry professionals as we bring you relevant and timely information on current agronomic practices. Please give our podcast a five-star rating and follow us on Twitter at SciPathology and at Sean Blumgren. You can also email us with questions or ideas for the show, apennyforyourthoughts@gmail.com. That's apenny4yourthoughts@gmail.com. Thank you always for joining us. Andrew, had a first part with Dr. Sean Castile, and we are back again. So in our first episode, we talked about high-speed planters and the use of digital imagery used for breeding and creating yield-predicting models. Dr. Castile gave us some great takeaways about how to think about some of that digital imagery and how we could use it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But Sean, thanks for coming back and joining us. Appreciate you taking time to talk about high input management in soybeans. Andrew, give us a little bit of guidance on what we're going to spend our episode doing today.
Yeah, this is the perfect culmination for our two-part series with Dr. Castile. You know, I often find myself talking with growers, with you and growers about high yield management soybeans. You know, what can we do differently? How can we think differently? And so I figure what better guest to have on than Sean Castile. So Sean, you know, let's start this conversation. Tell us about your research you did for high input management with soybeans and kind of what your end goals were.
Well, this is ongoing. This is like every year. So whether it's a one study or a culmination of studies. So, you know, we've got some good working relationships across the state lines with a combination of studies with other soybean agronomists. So there's years that when I first got here, we had intensive management studies. I think we coined the term SOYA, right? It's just a way of getting grants, right? You have to have some way
to, right. Got to create that acronym or magic word,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you've got to have some widget to make it worth funding. So we have that going on, and then we've done some other ones that are kind of addition dropouts, and obviously ones that are a different factor. So I've done a lot in this space, and so we can get into any aspect of it. So in terms of interactions with inputs that are during the growing season, I think you guys have a pretty good appreciation that I think there's a lot to do with the fertility base that we need to start with.
Yep.
There's foundations, right? I get asked to talk about expanding and high yield management of soybeans. So I always say, we've got to set foundations before we can even talk about these next little nuggets, or you want to call them silver bullets or gold bullets or just BBs, whatever they are. You've got to have foundations. And so that's what I always like to start with.
Yeah. So before we dig into some of these practices and the yield impact, what are, you know, just thinking about soybeans at a basic level, what are the main yield components in a soybean?
Yeah. So a soybean is a beautiful crop, and it can be a frustrating crop. You and I have already talked about the idea of trying to do a yield prediction. Just looking at it is like, well, yeah, I got a good pod load there, but then how big are those beans going to be at the end of the season? And how much is going on there? And so when you look at yield components, you know, obviously you have to have plants to get you there. So that's an understatement, right? But in terms of the next steps, you've got to have the pods, you got to have the seed per pod and seeds per size. Those are the three main ones we're talking about that. And so what's the beauty of that is that soybeans can adapt over a wide variety of conditions to either hold on to pods or hold on to the flowers that develop those pods, or to just abort them, right? And so it's, hey, no, it's too stressful, I'm going to abort flowers. You know, this is one area that a lot of people are like, I want to hold on to more flowers. Okay, that's fine. We lose upwards of 75% of our flowers every year.
Yeah.
Okay. And so like, oh, if I get a 5% increase and more flowers becoming pods, that's going to be a huge win for me. Well, yeah, you'll have more pods, but then what are you going to do with seeds per pod? And what are you going to do with seed size? So you're making the assumption when you do this, like more pods, I'm going to have bigger beans or have the same size beans. Well, what happens in a lot of cases, then the seed size goes down. So this is what's going on with this continuum and this interaction of yield components of soybeans.
Endlessly complicated.
Yeah. Well, I'm reminded of the phenomenal episode we had with my favorite guy, Dr. Westgate. You know, he went into quite a bit of detail talking about the impact of, you know, temperature, just environmental conditions on pod number, seed number, kernel weight or seed weight and all that stuff. So
So I guess before we talk high management, what are the basics that a grower has to have right before we can start talking about hay management?
Yeah, so I have this nice list, right? You think about what are the yield management decisions that growers make year in and year out. And so let's make sure we do hit those. So variety selection, you got to have ones that are going to have the yield consistency, yield potential, right? And so as I answer your questions, I'm going to answer them in terms of high production, but also high profit. So we kind of put that in both of this, right? Yep. You know, sometimes you can pick a variety that may not be the highest yielding, but you've got conditions. Let's say you've got Phytophthora year in, year out, or you've got white mold, and or you got some of the disease or some pressure that you've got to manage that more so.
We got it all.
So there you go, right? So you want something that yields well over all those conditions, right? Yeah. And if you look at variety trials, you know, that's a 6 to 12 bushel swing alone. Just in selecting the right variety, not doing anything else to it, that's a 6 to 12 bushel swing easy just on variety selection.
Yep.
Okay. And so that's in the high yield management. And within that, you think about maturity groups. I'm not going to play this one as much because we can think about doing an early maturing being planted earlier to catch old market price. And then now that's about profit, right? You're asking me high yield management. So this is a different scenario, right? You want to maximize your season altogether. The next ones that come into play is timely planting, right? This is huge, right? You've got to be out there timely, utilizing that season, right? And what I mean by that is it's not just being planted whenever. It's, okay, field conditions are fit or they're close to fit. So then we can kind of, I call it tricking the plant. A lot of people say, well, we've got these soybeans that respond to the sunlight. Well, it's actually not sunlight. It's responding to the night length, the photo period, in terms of transitioning. Well, they're transitioning from vegetative growth only to vegetative and reproductive growth. When we plant timely, we trick the plant in terms of harvesting more sunlight, more heat units in particular. So then we go from a very typical 18 noted plant to 20, 22, 23, 24 noted plants planted timely versus we wait until the end of May and we only have 17, 16 nodes. You lose out on a lot of those yield potentials of where those pods are placed. So again, this is an hour talk on this. So timely planting, variety selection comes into that. And then having the conditions that you're going to be managing your normal things, right? Weed control, make sure that we're not letting things get away from us. You think about some of any of the insects or that are might be a problem later in season, we can hit some of those early season. If we're planting timely, I usually am one like we probably definitely need the fungicide-based seed treatment to help with that. Where we're at, I don't see as much of a benefit or need for the insecticide. Maybe you guys, Iowa, you start to go to Minnesota, you might catch some of the earlier insects that we don't. I don't see that one as much of a case there. In line with the variety selection, I think about nematodes. And again, nematodes are just a pain in our existence. And so you need to get beyond just having PI 88, 78, 88 as your source. You need to think about peaking and other aspects of that. And then scouting, just to understand what's really going on in that field so you can manage it. And then and the final base is this idea of fertility, that we're not selling it short in terms of fertility. I'm not saying you have to pour everything to it, but boy, don't give it the mindset that it's a scavenger crop and you're not going to fertilize for high-yielding beans. You've got to at least have that there. So I think that at least sets a stage for a foundation before we can even move on.
Yeah, yeah. Thinking about this trial, how big was this trial, you know, all the data that you pulled into this trial? You know, how many treatments were there, state, site years, et cetera? What do you focus on in terms of pulling in data?
Yeah, and again, there's a number of these, so I'm not sure if you're talking about the soya trial. So within that one, usually that was back in the beginning when we had Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana. And even before I came to Indiana, there was another version of this where they probably had upwards of a 6 or 7 states. So pretty good representation, again, depending on which study we're talking about and high yield management collaboration. And then out of that, I'll talk with the soya one in particular. We had 3 basic studies. We had one that was like the soya that had a good number of treatments that were in single application. And then we had a few that we cherry picked. Okay, here's this combination. And then we'll drop out a couple of them. And this idea of having these singles, that's fairly like, is it this one treatment that's doing it, whether it's a nitrogen application or this is back in the day when Cobra was a big thing, right? That was in vogue to burn your beans, right? And so we had that one all by itself. Yeah, burn your beans and then baby them. And then those were in combination with all together. And then I think if there's about three or four that we took out one, right? And the idea was whenever you have the soya complete, this kitchen sink, if you will, of that study, all right, if we took out one of the management practices, let's say is fungicide, insecticide, or we took out cobra or whatever it was, or nitrogen, if the yield decreased from the complete or the kitchen sink, it was like, okay, that was our thought of saying that was the one that made the system work. That was the linchpin that we really need to work at. So that was a concept of kind of that soya study, if that's what you're referring to.
Yep, it is. Just, yeah, clarification. It is a soya study.
Yeah, yep. So how did you, I guess this is probably a continuance. It's probably not done, but how do you break down that data? You kind of talked about trying to find the linchpin. Are you sorting that data into groups of buckets?
Yeah, so there's a number of ways to slice and dice, right? You made the comment a moment ago, Andrew, with a statistician, or maybe it's just private conversation. It's like you can look at data every which way you want and almost make it do what you want. So there's big buckets. You say, okay, is there a trend, right? Is there a trend across all these environments? And so the location, so that's the holy grail. It's like, hey, is there just one thing or a couple things that it's common across all of them, right? That's the starting point. And then when you're like, oh, nope, that didn't work. Okay, now let's go through. Okay, is there a location effect or year effect? And so we bring that in to say, okay, is that separating in that way? And then another way of looking at this, a lot of common questions are, okay, does it matter based on yielding environment? And so I've always had kind of an issue with this, because the way we, and I've done it, all right, is this idea of yielding environments. Okay, this was low yielding environment, this is high yielding environment. And okay, is it because it was just that quote growing season that was low yielding environment versus, okay, that field, those fields are normally a high yielding field, right? So I add a little extra to this kind of question back to you guys on this is, high yielding environment could be just simply because we had weather that worked out well. Had a study last year that was on the sand. By all rights, I would consider that a low yielding environment, right? It was a dry land sand and we ran 85 bushel beans. Okay, so this is where I kind of put a little caveat to, okay, this is how we bucketed based on what the yields were at the end of the season, not our preemptive, okay, I think that's a high yielding environment because it's got good fertility, 3.5% organic matter. But that's the buckets that we created with this study.
It's really challenging when, you know, you're in an advisor role and you try and tease apart that, you know, that concept of, okay, really what is the largest contributing factor and how do we appropriately award yield to the right category. So thinking about the soya trial, and it sounds like ongoing research, but what treatments did you include and how have you decided what you want to include in these studies?
Yeah. So within this soya one, this is the idea of, right, come together with all the agronomists and so on this study. It's like, okay, what are the ones that we really want to look at and see if there's going to be a play? At that time, a lot of this, we were talking about these individual components, like I mentioned already. And so within that, you've got ones that are going to come into, we've got just untreated control, no seed treatment, right? That's where you start. And then you add in these. So whether it's an antioxidant, or I think that we kind of called it that, but that was really the cobra, that was a cobra treatment down later. We had ones that were a growth promoter, the idea of, okay, stimulating something that comes into play. We, at that point, we were just on the cusp of understanding, okay, do we need a fungicide seed treatment all the time? So we had a fungicide seed treatment. We had a fungicide plus insecticide seed treatment. We had a fungicide insecticide plus biologic, right? So we kind of stair-stepped those a little bit. We did a foliar fertilizer application R1. We did the cobra. We burned the tar out of these suckers.
just drop some napalm on them.
Yeah. So I think we were running 12 ounces of cobra and a quart of COC. So we burned the living tar out of them.
Wow.
And really the idea, and that was at V4, the idea and the concept that was being floated around back when we did that was, okay, you burn out the terminal and then you're going to get all these auxiliaries to really branch out. And so then you have a real branchy plant. And so I'll go and hit that one. I did that on some separate studies as well as this one. In my separate studies, I only had one time did it have a yield improvement. Every other time it had a yield decrease, right? And so the yield improvement, to answer that one, was we end up having a wet August, July and August. And so that early June, you know, just napalm, as you say it, you know, kept the plant very compact. And so we didn't get a lot of biomass. Well, that biomass was a detriment because they had too much in late season. Well, you're never going to know that with a June spray of this. Going back on the soy, so then again, trying to kind of tease out individually, we had a fungicide by itself, an insecticide by itself at R3, the combination. And then we also had a little bit of nitrogen applied at V4 to say, oh, we're limited on nitrogen supply. So then all of those together was the soya without the Cobra. And then we had other ones where we have this addition or subtraction. So those were minus the nitrogen, minus the fungicide, insecticide. That was the 16 treatment study. Again, a lot to work through, but that was what was going on.
So you did kind of put it together kind of like the great Fred Below's Seven Wonders of Corn, where he had everything combined so you could look at potential synergies, and then you just subtracted each. Okay, perfect. That's good.
Yep. And so within this, this is what I would call like a kind of like a modified additional mission design. So we've got the individuals, then we've got the complete, and then we would subtract out a few of them.
That's
it
awesome.
Wasn't a full. This was with the soya. I've actually got another study that I had a student do a couple years ago where we did a different set of high yield management addition and omissions. And it was a crazy 25 treatment study I can hit too.
I think it's great. We always try and make sure that we, you know, appropriately thank the people doing this hard work, because we have a tendency in row crop, you know, we do like one treatment in one side by side on a farm. And that's how we make an entire decision on whether or not we believe that product works, and don't appropriately take into account any of the variability that can come with that. And so it's always frustrating to try and do that in the real world, but let's kind of maybe just, Dr. Castile, go as deep as you want into the answer or maybe just spit out the response. But as we think about, like, just start in the beginning, you did a bunch of different trials with seed treatments. Help our growers and listeners think about seed treatments based on your learning.
Yeah. So this is where it does. There's so many complicating factors to this, right? If someone was to look at this, and I actually pulled up some of my slides from the talk I gave on this years ago, refresh my memory. I'm looking at this, right? And I think I've made the comment very clear that, okay, timely planting, probably need a fungicide seed treatment.
Yep.
And if you were to look at this study in particular, our results are across all these interactions, there's nothing that plays there. And so I think we've got to also put the caveat of understanding how the study was set up and what's the point of whatever management treatment you're doing. And so in particular, you know, maybe we weren't pushing the planting date as early on these, and, you know, I don't have that data in front of me. And so if you're pushing those things and understanding what that management technique or practice is doing for you, I think that's where you can still take data like we got, where, I mean, quite literally the fungicide and insecticide seed treatments don't pay, right? They're not showing it right there within any of our combinations in this particular study. However, I'm going to still be quick to say, I think we need to make sure we consider fungicide seed treatments because of pushing planting dates earlier. We have got conditions that are more conducive to some of those early seedling diseases. So that's an answer with another answer to qualify that.
Well, yeah. And if it was ever as simple as just a green light, red light, it'd be, we wouldn't need all this, all this research. But so thinking about seed treatment, then moving to soybean inoculants, it seems like the market is flooded with low-cost inoculants, certainly over the last decade. I mean, you know, you can buy some inoculants, I think, you know, pushing down around a dollar. What have you learned about inoculants?
Yeah, so within inoculants, if you've been, again, Bradyrhizobium, let's be clear what we're talking about. Bradyrhizobium japonicum, if you've been in a corn-soybean rotation and you've already had the inoculant introduced, you've already got the bacteria introduced, if it's corn soybean rotation, you know, we really don't see the yield advantage there. But I'll be also say, if it's $1, $2, okay, that doesn't, I mean, I don't want to be sold short on nitrogen, right? So that doesn't bother me as much. And here's a case last year. So the month of May, end of May and early June, very dry. And we had soybeans. I think you guys had this as well. Soybeans were short. They weren't growing well.
Yep.
You turn dry. You have issues with nodulation and fixation. I've got a few trials last year that I included the Bradyrhizobium in our biological. So different, completely different study than what we're talking today. But I had, you know, these new biologicals in the mix as well as some old ones. So we've got the non-rhizobial foliar applied V4s versus a bradyrhizobium seed treatment. And last year on a field that I would anticipate probably wouldn't see a response, I saw a 4-bushel gain with it. So I think it's about what the growing conditions are going to be like. And so ultimately we can't decide that fully and know it, but when we were hot and dry, we were nitrogen deprived, we saw a benefit out of it. To quote a study that actually Iowa State, Pella Peterson, before he moved on to industry, you know, he culminated a lot of the inoculant work across the Midwest. I believe it was about 72 trials. And so out of that summary, beautiful study of summarizing that 63 out of 73 times, you didn't need it, right? And so then I think he had about 4 out of the 73 that got a yield increase or a decrease, actually. 4 out of the 73 decreased yield with a bradyrhizobium and 6 increased it. So by and large, you don't need it, is the storyline. But if it's a cost point that doesn't cause you any real trouble, there could be some benefit from time to time.
Yeah. I know we get a lot of, Andrew and I spend a lot of time, and it's why we enjoy doing these types of interviews, because I think the trick can be you can spend a lot of money a few bucks at a time. And so, you know, specifically in the high management conversation, it's how do we take our per acre budget or our farm budget and apply it most appropriately. So really good.
I'm going to interject and add to that, because I gave a talk yesterday and biologicals are huge. There's no doubt about that. And so I got asked all the time on this one yesterday and over the winter, and I'm not going to say names on this one, but it's like, does this work? And that's a conversation I have every year. And I look at 12 to 13 species that are within here, and they've done a nice job that they package it with, you know, you're already going to put talc or graphite, so then this is a replacement, right? So like, okay, that's a nice marketing, a nice delivery system. I haven't looked at that one in particular, but the grower yesterday said it's an $18 investment. I'm like, and you don't know anything about it yet, right? And so you talk about a dollar too. I mean, shoot, you go to $18, $20 investment, and you don't know if it's actually doing anything for you. Right. We need to be testing that. Let's look at that.
That's like speaks to the heart of what I think Andrew and I spend so much of our discussion time when we're not on the air is evaluating, you know, and you don't want to miss an opportunity, right? So if there is something out there, you want to utilize it. But at the same time, you got to ask yourself, you kind of talked about this with the fungicide, what am I trying to solve for? Right. What am I trying to solve for? And do I understand the mode of action and site of action? So whatever tool I'm using could potentially be a part of that.
Boy, I think what is said in Iowa is said in Indiana, because I think you said the exact words that I heard yesterday. Well, I don't want to lose out on an opportunity. Quite literally, same words.
Yep. Yeah.
Same word.
We saw, let's be in the water.
We saw a lot. It really is. It's the heart of this podcast, I think, is I want to make sure that if we're going to say something to our growers, we understand what we're trying to solve for and believe, you know, you mentioned ROI versus, you know, versus yield and all those things. It's complex. And as the economy gets tighter in ag, you can't just, you've got to be intentional about what you're trying to solve for. So sorry to drag us down a buddy trail, but
no, it's good. Good conversation. So Sean, we often get, and I'm sure you too, we get a lot of questions about nitrogen in soybeans, right? Yep. Is there a time and a place, you know, if I'm in those high yield situations where I'm expecting that 75 or above, you know, will side dressing or any kind of nitrogen impact yield? So what do you see in this trial?
Yeah, so this trial, and then I'll go beyond. This trial, we put out, if I recall, let me go back to my notes on this one. Yeah, we put out 70 units of nitrogen, half urea, half slow release, so like an ESN type, and that, again, to kind of spoon feed that on just nitrogen alone. And in this study, across the locations that we did that, did not see the benefit out of it, all right? So that's just nitrogen supply alone. So I hit that one pretty quick. That's going from Kentucky, Wisconsin, Minnesota, right, Kansas, to us and everywhere in between. Did not see it. But I make the comment about what can we do for nitrogen supply. And what I go with in terms of a lot of the work that I've been gaining ground on in terms of yield is the sulfur that's affecting nodulation, that's affecting nitrogen fixation, that's affecting nitrogen supply. That's where I think there's a lot of gain. I think there's a lot of opportunity. Is it every field? No. I want growers to hear that. It's, That's where you need to investigate that. And so that interaction has been just fascinating, right? I've got planting date interactions where crazy responses on a prairie soil that by all rights shouldn't need anything more. 77 bushel beans that are untreated, and we were on 9,900 bushel beans when we add the sulfur to boost the fixation. So
yeah.
I think that again, that's an episode of its own, just to kind of go through the nuances of that, because I cannot do it justice in a 2-minute answer of that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a perfect segue into one of the questions we had. I mean, you've done some pretty interesting work with sulfur. And again, we'll just be quick on this.
Yep.
You know, you did looking at starter with sulfur. And you know, tell us about what you did and what you saw in response for with those trials.
Yeah, so I'm going to answer this outside of, so I've got two conditions that I describe. I've got the sulfur deficient fields year in and year out. So the classic coarse textured fields that are going to respond. I'm not going to talk about those. I'm going to put it in the category of the ones like, okay, we've induced some sort of management that is responding to this. And in particular, the one that I'm excited about and really want to see how much it plays out across a lot of geography is this planting date interaction. This is the one that everyone is, so we're pushing planting dates on soybeans. And so that's great earlier, but what are those soil conditions like? Usually they're going to be what? Cooler, right? A little bit wetter. Yep. Are soybeans growing fast in that environment? No. And that's a good thing, because let's go physiologically. That means then we're going to have a nice compact plant, right? Again, we can have a whole discussion on that. Now go back to the soil. If you're on cooler soils, are the microbial activity, is the microbial activity as fast?
Less mineralization.
Less mineralization. And so this interaction has just been fascinating, that I've got timely planted versus late here on a prairie soil. And we're consistently gaining ground in terms of yield with a timely planted crop with a sulfur addition, because I don't think we're getting enough mineralization of that sulfur that's needed early root development. Where, okay, so it's not root development, it's about where the bacteria infect the root hairs. So they need sulfur as a cofactor. So if they're not getting it, they're not getting it from the atmosphere, and we're not getting it mineralized fast enough, there's not going to be as much nodulation. They're going to be sold short on nitrogen. You're sold short on nitrogen in soybeans, you are sold short on yield in a major way.
Yeah.
So within this, you know, on the average, we're an 8 to 11 bushel swing with a sulfur source planted timely. And there's versus the first week of June, just to go off the cliff, it's warm enough soil mineralizing it, and there's no benefit from that sulfur. And so understanding the conditions that are limiting your sulfur, and then to try to maximize that return. So timely planting is going to give a case where we're probably going to be limited in sulfur supply.
Yeah.
No-till conditions. If you run cover crops, tying up that sulfur, those are going to be cases I want to at least explore this interaction.
And that's some wonderful info.
What's that?
That's some wonderful info right there. I mean, as we continue to talk planting date with soybeans, how often do we get growers where we're doing that, but we don't have little tidbits like this where you're seeing a very consistent response? And it makes sense, right? You got early cooler soils, less mineralization.
Well, you know, yeah, it's so valuable for me. You know, when I'm on here, you know, I always joke I'm the dumbest person in the room. But I have a lot of these conversations, like what you're talking about that you had yesterday, where I think it helps to so specifically say, hey, that tub or that box or that concept or that liquid may have an impact, but we have to understand what specifically are we trying to solve for. So you just described exactly why that sulfur interaction could impact it. Now you go to go to somebody that's going to wait till May 20th and heavy organic soil that has had a significantly higher amount of mineralization, you're probably going to decrease the likelihood. The product is no more or less viable, right? It's just whether or not prescriptively it's going to have a positive interaction. So it's appreciate those answers, because it helps frame in those conversations. We try to think, you know, there's really not a good or bad product. There's some bad products, but I mean, a lot of these products have merit. It's just we try to blast them out over every acre.
So figuring out when and where they work. Yeah,
absolutely. So
you also had some really good information looking at insecticides. And this kind of reminded me of a lot of fungicide trials. You know, we often talk about fungicides when there's no disease present. And it kind of reminded me of that. So tell me about that, you know, what you had in terms of results with your insecticide applications.
Yeah, so I'm going to answer several levels of this. Like, go back to the soya. The ones that had fungicide and insecticides at R3 application. And so those were playing out pretty well for us in terms of an insecticide benefit of that R3 application across a lot of the, we categorized them as average yielding environments, the high yielding environments, the combination was really needed within that. So I think there's some interesting play there within that study. In some of my more recent work here locally, I push that foliar protection to R4. So an early R4 is what I shoot for. A lot of people are still R3. I'm going for a little bit later. And the reason I do that is because of our work of looking at seed fill later in development. And so trying to maximize the protection of the leaves. And what's been coming out in the last few years is the protection of the pods. And so we've got some areas that have some pretty interesting bean leaf beetle pressures, green stink bug, a few others. By all rights, individually, they are not at threshold. But I really wonder if, is there any way that we can come up, the entomologist, this agronomist can't figure it out, but is there a pest complex threshold, right? This idea, we got some bean leaf beetles, we got some green stink bugs, and I know that's complicated in its own right, but I think that we're probably reaching levels in this combination that's of issue. And then the final part of this is that we're protecting now the pods, right? There's some of this leaf protection that's occurring, but I think like an R4 and some of my work is that we're protecting the pods. And so now we're protecting one to two more pods. Well, that started to stair steps pretty quick that now we're not losing that one to two pods, right? And per plant, then we're holding on to those. And that's a 4 or 5 bushel swing or 8 bushel swing. So that's what's kind of interesting. And I say that with the idea that we're not at threshold individually. So you want to just be good stewards of what we have, but it's kind of hard to work through that when you see some consistent results in this space.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
That almost feels like we've now said 3 or 4 times we need an episode on its own, but I feel like we haven't even scratched the surface of that conversation. Like that to me, I don't know if we can, it'd be fun to put an entomologist on.
Yeah.
And kind of go through some of this research and say, how do we think about that? Cause I know for me, it's one of the most frustrating things we do is go out and try and scout soybeans and make insecticide applications. And your comment about stewardship, I mean, jiminy Christmas, if you look at any of the politics around this stuff right now, besides our real responsibility for stewardship, there's also the public appearance and everything going on in the political landscape. But
that's one I struggle with every year. I was raised by an old hippie, and I mean, I'm a nature guy, and I don't like, you know, going out there and just killing insects, especially you look at all the beneficials that we have that keep those thresholds lower on the ones that are harming plants. And, you know, the whole bee conversation, you know, that's something I struggle with every year because, you know, more often than not, we put insecticides on when we likely don't need them. But then you see data like this and it's hard to ignore.
It's also really tricky when you're in an advisor role because you sit there into the conversation about inoculants, right? It's only a couple bucks.
Yeah.
You know, if insecticides cost $12 an acre or $16 an acre, we'd be far more careful with our approach. But when you can throw a generic insecticide in for $1.50, it's like, well, I'm already making the pass.
Yeah.
The mentality is, well, I'll lose access to the field if I don't utilize the path. But again, we'll attempt to somewhat stay efficient here. It seems like there's a lot of questions about foliar fertilizers and these micronutrient packs, some of the stuff we can maybe take through the field when we're doing our planned passes through the field. What did you learn about those?
Yeah, foliar fertilizers, this is one that, I mean, fairly consistent that we're not seeing the response. So this is within the soya study that we kind of use as our base to have conversation today. But, you know, a number of agronomists did for a couple of years, several different versions of foliar applications. At R1, it's just as far as just doing it to do it without having any nutrient cause, there wasn't the benefit. There hasn't been the benefit out of that. And so let's go with one. You know that I've talked a lot about sulfur and say, oh, we get sulfur with that foliar one. Well, if you look at these 1-2 quart products and this discussion of sulfur alone, at best you're getting a half pound of sulfur.
Yeah.
If you really need it, you are not doing it justice. You are not going to get the response.
You got to be hugely deficient.
you've got to have a lot more. And I've done that work in terms of if you're trying to recover from a sulfur deficiency, you need 3 to 4 pounds of sulfur in a foliar spray. You're not getting these one, right, two core products. The other foliar fertilizers that come to mind, right? You think about, you know, there's a lot out there and we haven't looked at everything. So not to say that there can't be the situations for the response, but let's go with situations where you do have manganese deficiency, right? We've got pockets of that and that's classic. Yep. We're going to do 2 to 3 passes every year on these fields because they are just manganese deficient. So give me a quarter to half a pound of manganese, whether it's manganese sulfate or manganese ETTA or something like that. Those are classic. Yep. Give me the condition that's going to need it. But if you're not deficient, I'm not seeing the response. There's some other ones that have come out in the last few years that are, you know, it's a boron base, it's a zinc, and there's some other micros that come with it. And I just haven't seen the consistency out of those on soybeans on a prophylactic nature.
Yeah. So the kind of the culmination question, you mentioned the soya response numerous times, and that's for our listeners, that's the combination of all of these treatments combined into one, right? Looking at the effect of the high input soybean management. So what did you see with the soya response, all inputs, all treatments involved in this? What do you see?
Yeah. So when all of these were put together, right, on the average across all these locations and years, you know, from a high yielding environment, we were probably averaging 80 bushel untreated control. You know, it was about a 4 bushel swing, go up to 84. Right. And so that's not a big swing if you really think about it with everything that you put into it, right? You put in a fungicide seed treatment, you put in a foliar fertilizer, you put in a fungicide, insecticide, and some nitrogen, right? That's not a huge swing. And so I don't have the dollar numbers here, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out pretty quick that, you know, put all that together, it's probably not as profitable. The ones that we're playing is like, okay, we need to really consider the foliar fungicide insecticide and what was going out with this data set. If I recall, we did have some pretty good pressures of insect up in the north on that set. So I think that has a pretty big play on how this one responded, right? So that's how I can answer that study in particular. I'll use some of my data to kind of further this point of like this foliar fungicide insecticide. I've done the prophylactic applications for years, right? And all of by themselves, I've had year after year where there's nothing going on. There's no response to these individually. But then now I've got a base of sulfur applied. And this one's been the fun part is that we've improved fixation. We've improved nitrogen supply and leaf retention. Now we've also gained something that's protecting those pods. There's been some interesting synergies with that one. So that's a different study than what we started with, but there's some systems that are starting to kind of play out that, okay, prophylactically, not seeing it, but when I had something that improved my nitrogen supply, there seemed to be some play there. And so that's something to look for. Yeah.
Dr. Castiles, you think about kind of the culmination of your soybean research. What about some of the practices we're using on corn? So starter fertilizer, in-furrow fungicide, is there room for some of those maybe already implemented practices to come over to the soybean side?
Yeah, so I think that's a great, great question in terms of, let's go with starters. Starters and soybeans, the big play on that one is, okay, the setup to get it accomplished, right? What was our foundation? We talked about timely planting, narrow rows. And so now you've got me into a 30-inch planter. Well, I don't like that at all, right? And so what can you do, right? Because you've missed out on the foundational thing. So we can do that. And I've done those, right? And we can get some yield improvement on some situations in a starter. You know, I think in particular with the earlier planting that had some sulfur issues, we got the benefit, but not as much as doing a granular application of AMS across the board. So I'd still rather do a 15-inch bean or 20-inch. So that has to be in context. This idea of in-furrow, I know there's some traction there within the corn world. We are going to start looking at some of those this year more. So that might be an interesting play with the in-furrow or a pop-up, something like that on the protection side. Probably not as much on the nutrient side, but I think, you know, corn, a lot of people like the zinc, and I just haven't seen it play out there. But, you know, certainly what we see in the corn, we try in the soybeans as well.
Yeah. So, Sean, you've also done some really interesting work looking at different soybean cultivars and the response to high and low input systems. And, you know, I ask this question because, you know, in corn, when we're looking at certain hybrids, you know, certain hybrids we often term racehorse, workhorse, right? You know, some that will respond to the high yield, you know, high input management, some won't. What did you see in there in your research? Are there soybean cultivars that respond more to high management, or is it kind of just flatline?
Yeah. So another aspect of the soya study was that was our attempt. It's like, okay, and we talked to the company, said, give us the variability, right? They give us the variability in cultivars that are, as you call it, racehorse or workhorse, or here's one with high yield, but that's so-so.
Offensive, so, defensive.
Yeah. All of those qualifiers, right? So you get all those to come into play. And then we cross that up with our untreated control versus the soya complaint. So everything. So, you know, kind of cherry pick a few of these intense management ones and look at the interactions. And out of that set, we only had 3 out of 53 times did we have any interaction with the variety by this management. And so in that set, I mean, it indicates that we really don't see much going on. Again, going to the company and say, you give us the ones that are supposed to respond to management, and out of the set, just not seeing it. And so I think that's where we continue to land on this, is that, okay, if you've got a good yielding variety in terms of yield potential, it's going to respond to management in its own right. But as far as interactions, I just haven't seen it play.
If you had to offer our listeners kind of maybe I don't even know if this is a fair question. It might be too narrow, but if you were to say your key learning has been, do you have a key takeaway?
Well, this idea of intense management is really rooted in being intentional with the soybean. And so to understand, you know, what's going on. I think that's what I tried to share with you guys and everyone else in conversation, is to understand the why it did or why it did not work. And so I think that's the biggest thing, is to have the notes in such a way that you can say, yeah, I had response to sulfur this year. Oh, probably because we did plant on April 15th. No, I didn't, because I probably planted on May 15th. Or, you know, I went out there with all of this biologicals and nothing happened. Or I did. All right, we've got biological work where we've got some responses, but it's probably because we had a bacteria that has an effect on phosphorus supply in a low phosphorus environment, right? Yeah. So I think that's the biggest thing, right? The silver bullet, if that's what you're really asking me, I can't give other than to really think about why you do or don't see a response.
Yeah.
This is, there's always, I don't ever get to tell like what I learned, because the way our show set up, Andrew always gets to give his key takeaways. It's kind of BS, but I think, like, you know, I always walk away with like kind of an aha moment from these shows. And I think the best one for me from a sales perspective or interacting with a grower would be to simply say, what are you trying to solve for? Right. So even that case where you give that biological example is great. Did, you know, a yield response is what we're obviously looking for, ROI, but what was the root cause of that yield reaction? Because maybe we're masking a problem. We joke, because we know some instances where we have people that are using a product and it's like they're attributing yield success to a product, and really what it's doing is it's exposing or showing an opportunity based on a soil amendment that could probably be fixed otherwise. Right. So
I think the struggle with this, I'm going to interject right quick here. Like, I go with, again, a conversation I just had yesterday, and it's like, okay, what do you think about tillage? Right. And last year, for a lot of our growers, our no-till soybeans took it on the chin, right? We had a rough condition early on with our no-till. And so what I don't want people to do is like take that one instance, this one year, and then completely change everything. So whether that's a foliar fungicide, insecticide, if it's a sulfur application, because I talked to them and kind of worked through, yeah, your work ground on the headlands yielded great because we were so dry early, and that root system wasn't able to establish in the same way in a no-till. So now you understand that, and then you can manage for that. It doesn't mean you need to be doing an about face and change everything, go a whole hog into
right.
it.
Yeah.
Right. That, I do not want people to do that. Lose out on, you know, whether it's an insecticide as a treatment that you can have in years, or you got fungicide that's now QI resistant, right? You know, this is a thing that we want to avoid. We want to make smart management decisions.
Yeah. So Sean, our last question before I have a surprise question for both you and Sean at the end. I told him I got a surprise question that you and Dr. Castillo will get to answer for me. Before that, my final question, you know, we often get those situations where growers like, man, I feel like I'm doing everything I can. My potash levels, pH is all good. You know, I'm in the scenario where I'm expecting 75 bushel beans coming off 5 years continuous corn. Is there anything that those growers can do who feel like they've done everything right, you know, the basics? Is there anything you feel like they could do or try to maybe take that 75 or 80 bushel soybean yield to 85 or 90?
See, that's hard, right? Because you've set me up with not knowing, okay, what's everything for them, right? You know, I had this one yesterday. I'm going back to yesterday. So the idea is to understand, okay, let that plant talk to you. You feel like you said you're a hippie growing up and be the plant whisperer, right? This idea of understanding what the soybean is telling you. So that's what I often say is, okay, let the crop tell you what's going on. And what I mean by that is to set it up in a way that you can say definitively, I made this one change in this strip or multiple strips in the field. So then you can learn from that. Take the leaf sample, take the drone imagery, whatever it is. So then you can learn. And then you apply it all across the board. I think that's the biggest thing for me. And again, not knowing, okay, what's everything for a grower that's locked at 75 or 80. Yesterday, the conversation was, I'm an 80 bushel irrigated soybean producer. What am I missing? Like, well, you got to give me some more details than that, right? And then, you know, I start to learn that they put out potash right at planting. Well, all right, there you got the chloride that's probably causing you some issues with the root system. So that's the thing. Start peel away. What are the management strategies and what are those effects and what are those intents?
Yeah. Andrew recently gave a talk at an event that we were at, and it was, you know, the idea of chasing a 300 bushel average, and walked through just kind of almost reverse engineering the Liebig's law, right? And so what I was thinking is, you gave us, I wrote down 8 notes at the beginning of this around like, this is the basics. And then the idea of being a continual learner. So I think when I have this conversation, I want to say, hey, you know, go put your magic box of whatever product in the corner, and let's start with this list of 7 or 8 things. And if we feel like we're executing those well, then you know, almost reverse engineer the research you guys are doing. Then let's plug one thing in, solve for what the effect was, and do that work on our farm. But I think often we're skipping 2 or 3 of the fundamental steps, definitely, and then trying to do the other one. So has been really, really good.
It's been phenomenal. So before we let Sean wrap up this episode, so here's my question to put you guys on the spot. I wish we had Sean Conley on here, because this would make it even better. So we have the Sean spelling. So we have Blumgren, S-E-A-N.
Yep.
We have Castillo, S-H-A-U-N. And then we have Sean Conley, S-H-A-W-N.
Yep.
So I'm curious, is there something like spelling problems with Sean's, or is there a correct way to spell Sean? What's the correct way to spell Sean? I'm curious.
Well, as long as it starts with S-H, I'm still okay.
Man. Wow. That's fantastic. We'll leave it at that. Because I feel like if we did an episode with the three Seans, no one would care about the one that starts with the S and the E. There's not a lot of value coming out of this, but that's fantastic. That would be a very big personality episode if we got all three of us on there. We have a couple ways we wrap our show, Dr. Castile. So you've done just really, really cool research. It's obviously, we could keep you on here for hours and hours. But I guess maybe as you think about your research to date, do you have like one thing that you just are just really proud of, like the contribution or that just really amps you up?
Yeah, we've hit it a number of times. And I think the idea that we have gotten out of soybeans as that rotation crop has just, and again, it's not just me, right? But I mean, it's the collective agronomy family, right? It's folks like you, it's folks like Conley in Wisconsin, the idea that, hey, we need to plant timely. I was having text messages this morning with Laura Lindsay over at Iowa State and talking about planting dates. And so this idea that we're really coming into a group effort, I think that, you know, pushing soybeans, I think timely planting is a big part of that. I think then now looking at these interactions of management with that. So I think that's been a linchpin for us in transitioning soybeans to a higher yield level. within Indiana, across the nation for that matter. And then, I mean, for me, I've had a lot of work on the sulfur. Again, it's not everywhere, but boy, to see that interplay and see a visual response in soybeans, it's not like corn, right? You can get a visual response in corn easy, right? You do anything with nitrogen and some of those interactions, but to do that in soybeans and to see, you know, you have one treatment. I ran 77 bushels that went to 99 or 100. That's fascinating. That gets me jazzed up.
Really, really appreciate you. We talked about Sean Conley. You just mentioned a couple other great people that are involved in this, but I know for us, it drives the energy, the excitement, and changes the conversation really at the turn row, which is really important. So, Andrew, I don't get to share my opinion, so give me, I'd like to cash in my penny.
Yeah, so we got some great takeaways here. I think I got three this time. So the first one that really stood out, you know, we talked about planting depth and maybe those high speed, you know, incorporating high speed planters into soybean. You know, I think the main point you discussed, Sean, was that, you know, as long as you're 1.5, that's where you kind of like to be. You know, we talk about these different conditions where we might be a little bit drier or wetter in certain, you know, drier in search of moisture. You know, it's hard to answer that, right? Depending on tillage practices, the soil, you know, are you fluffy? You know, just there's a lot of factors. So 2 gets a little scary, 1.75 inches, but as long as, you know, 1.5, I think that's kind of the sweet spot, right? The second key takeaway, I found it really interesting, the response, and it got me and Sean thinking differently about this, you know, potential starter fertilizer and sulfur use in soybeans. I mean, we're making the recommendation, go out, plant soybeans first, you know, for April 5th, get some soybeans in the ground, right? Mm-hmm. With that, you see a really consistent response with starter and specifically sulfur, right?
Mm-hmm. So, and also I want to be clear on that one. So it's having sulfur there early, mm-hmm. and not as much the starter itself. So our work has been more on like a granular AMS or a pelletized gypsum. And again, I'm stealing your thunder, but I want it to be clear that, you know, our work has been at planting, but I think if we're within 6-7 weeks of planting with those soluble sources, those are a good opportunity for us to see the potential benefit with the earlier plantings.
Yep. That's good. Good. And then I think my final one is just kind of ties in with this whole episode, thinking differently about soybeans, right? We have all this technology we use in corn. Let's start implementing some of that in soybeans. What can we do to increase yields incrementally, right? We're not going to have those big 10 to 20 bushel gains, maybe like we've seen with Roundup. But you know, if we start doing these incremental things, and one of those being the use of a high speed planter, focus on singulation, focus on speed, you know, spacing, planting depth, and more importantly, you know, looking at the impact that you saw in your research, there was no going backwards with soybeans in terms of, you know, using a high speed planter. So let's start implementing some of this technology like high speed planters in soybean production. See where we can go.
Yeah. Excellent. Dr. Castile, these shows are super humbling. We get to come on and kind of pick apart or glean from your research, which just years and years of dedication. We're super appreciative of the time that you're willing to spend with us, but more so just your passion and commitment to learning and being part of driving this conversation. So thank you for taking the time on behalf of our listeners and our podcast, helping to teach Andrew and I, but also just for driving this conversation, you know, around the soybean belt. I'm taking a 2-year terms, timely planting and the soybean belt, but just really appreciative of you, Andrew. As we get as we wrap up today, give our listeners a teaser about who we're going to have next.
Yeah, as always, I'm excited about our next guest. He's one of the best weed scientists in the U.S. From the University of Wisconsin. There's our teaser, and I think we're also going to have a huge and influential person as a guest co-host.
Awesome.
From Iowa State.
Yeah, Dr. Castile, as we finish, if our listeners want to look at the research you're doing or just follow you, tell us how to do that.
Yeah, so there's a couple of avenues. So I'm on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, Purdue Soybean. You'll find me pretty quick there to get any of the information, latest tweets on that. We also have our own podcast that we get a lot of this information out, Dan Quinn and I, so Purdue Crop Chat. So we'll do very similar things that you and I have done, as well as anything within Purdue Soybean, Googling it, you'll get us. And so whether that's going to be any of my reports or presentations that I've given.
Dr. Castile, thank you. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks,
you again. Guys. I enjoyed it.
Been awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of A Penny for Your Thoughts. Please help us grow our audience by giving us a 5-star rating and sharing our social media on Twitter at Sean Blumgren and at SciPathology. You can also find our episodes on LinkedIn. We love your feedback. Please email us at apennyforyourthoughts@gmail.com. That's apenny4yourthoughts@gmail.com. As always, thank you for tuning in.